You're listening to Buildopedia, your go-to podcast for everything you need to know about property. By covering the entire journey from buying your home through to design, building, selling, and everything in between, we'll help you fill in the blanks and bring your property vision to life.
Hey, it's Matt here. And before we get stuck into today's episode, thank you so much, Stephen, for being a good sport and joining us, Stephen from Bardia Perry. And Stephen does get into some pretty technical stuff, so bear with him. He's amazing. He's passionate. But if you do need some help, it's not legal advice, by the way. We're not giving you legal advice. It's just something to demystify and get you thinking about land environment court a little bit differently. If you need legal advice, we'll put you in touch with Stephen. But here you go. Look me up and I'd be very happy to hear your thoughts. So send me an email if you've got any questions for Stephen. Okay, here's the episode. Welcome to the latest episode of Buildopedia. Joining us today is special guest, good friend and longtime advisor, solicitor for disclosure, Stephen Griffiths from Bardia Perry. He's a partner at Bardia Perry. He's nominated for Lawyer of the Year and he's an expert in environmental planning. Welcome to the podcast. Thanks for coming, Stephen.
Thanks, Matt. Thanks for having me. Very nice to be invited to be a part of this great information sharing exercise that you're embarking on. So, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so the reason we thought we'd get you on is because you've formerly been at council. You formerly worked at a council as a lawyer representing them in-house, as I understand. So we're trying to get under the hood a little bit of particularly the Land Environment Court, and which you've had quite a number of dealings with, both in mediation, representation. So give us a bit about your background and, how you've come to be a land environment lawyer.
Yes, well, I started off as a junior town planner in local government. I started off at Cogra Council when I first got to Australia and was a bit of a fish out of water for a while, but after that, got involved in lots of development matters, development assessment, strategic planning, and working for a range of different councils, and as a private consultant as well. And it was really the work that I did while I was at various councils on development appeals and also enforcement matters that sort of piqued my interest in planning law. And so, looking back on it now, it was a great decision, but at the time it seemed pretty daunting. I embarked on 6 years of night school to get to become a Juris Doctor, qualifying me to act as a solicitor in the highest court in the land, but also in the Land Environment Court, which would become my focus. And yes, that town planning background, that local government background has stood me in good stead to act on matters in the Land Environment Court for both developer clients and for council clients, where there's a limited sort of act for councils through the firm. But my practice primarily focuses on developers and development appeals, where decisions of consent authorities, usually local councils, are adverse and have to be challenged.
And when you say developer, I just want to clarify that that doesn't mean big developers necessarily. We're talking about, like, you obviously do all sorts of matters, not just for developers, builders, or if people come to you with their planning matter, right? You don't have to be a professional to come to you for help.
Yes. In terms of my use of the word developer, that sort of encompasses everybody who is looking to develop some form of land. It's probably one of the misconceptions that we'll get to speak about shortly as to who the court is there for. But it's basically, I advise everyone from the person looking to extend their house to a developer looking to build multiple dwelling developments or even commercial and industrial developments. And the range is great. The variety is very interesting for me. And absolutely. You know, the humble Altonads is the kind of development that I give advice on, that you see more and more now in the court under an appeal. And so the court is there for everybody.
And before we go into that, I'm remembering a conversation we had a very long time ago after, a Bardia Perry function, and you were telling me that you came to Australia to play rugby. Is that right? Do I remember that right? And so we've got a bit of a connection there. You played much higher level than I did. I played at the drunken under 21s where, everyone packing into the scrum was hungover. But you played at a much, much higher level. So tell us about that.
Sounds like a bit of a stereotypical Welshman, but I did come to Australia originally to play rugby. The plan was to play a couple of seasons here, perhaps, and then go back in a blaze of glory and resume what had been a very brief professional career in Wales. But the many delights in Australia and in Sydney sort of caught my attention, and it never really panned out that way. And before too long, I knew that the rugby career was coming to an end, and other things were taking my focus. And so I never went home, and my mum has never forgiven me for it. But this is actually my 20th year here. And so I'm not far off now, having spent more time in Australia than I did in Wales. And I'm part of the furniture now, I'd like to think.
Occasionally you have to practice maintaining that Welsh accent, like you have to actually work at it.
I would be hung up, drawn and quartered if I lost it, I think. I tend to think that it works for me as well sometimes. When you're presenting in court, having a slightly different accent adds a bit of interest, and I think it works, so I wouldn't want to lose it anyway.
Oh, yeah, well, it wouldn't be Stephen if he wasn't that thick Welsh. Very well, and it wouldn't be Stephen if he wasn't very well dressed. Probably even for a lawyer, exceptionally well dressed. And I found out why recently. Tell us why you've got the most amazing suits and ties, and like, what's your secret?
Well, the reason is that my wife works in fashion, and there was a particular period where she worked for a prominent menswear firm, and basically kitted me out for probably the rest of my working career in some pretty decent gear. So yeah, unfortunately I have to say that it's not me, it's the wife. And that's pretty embarrassing to say publicly.
That's all good. It's all good. So we'll kick off. We normally kick off. Sometimes I forget. A lot of the times I've forgotten, but this time I've remembered. Do you have an inspiration that you'd like to share, or person, or whatever it is?
Yeah, well, we have got a 6-week-old son in the house, and so he's really the inspiration at the moment, and taking all of the attention and time when not at work. And so he's my inspiration to do well for him and to be a role model for him. Yes, the first one. So it has been a sort of experience that has changed the focus of away from being pretty selfish and looking out for yourself to having somebody else who is, you've got a mold into your image. So,
yeah, absolutely. Well, congratulations.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Yeah, but that's brilliant. So let's jump into, I guess the idea I had for this podcast was to really pick out some misconceptions and myths around land environment court, because it is this mythical beast that people are scared of and wary of, and they don't really understand what happens. And it's not, my experience is not as bad as it seems, or as people perceive, where they think, oh, well, if I just file an application, I'm going to have to cough up at least 50 grand, maybe 100. But I mean, in your view, what are some misconceptions? What are the things that people often get wrong, when particularly like mum and dad developers, more so than the big developers?
Yeah, well, I think you've touched on a few of them there. The first one, as we mentioned earlier, is that the Land and Environment Court is only for big developers working on big developments, and, you know, lawyers at 10 paces, lots of important people standing around talking about a development, and it's really not that at all. It's a court that is open to everybody, and there is no issue or dispute in relation to land and environment and development that is too big or too small for the court. So as I said, the humble alterations and additions to a person's private home has just as much importance in the court as, you know, a development for X amount of units. And I'm certainly seeing, and I do a lot of matters currently for that kind of scale of development where we're dealing with smaller lots. Space is critical because of cost of land. And perhaps there's a family aspect to it as well. Like myself now, if I need to add another bedroom to the house to accommodate a growing family, then that is the kind of thing that is quite rightly welcomed in the court. And particularly where I think the regulation of development is getting stricter by councils and there are more objectors, people are more aware of the impacts of development and look to protect what they have more keenly. That's where obtaining development consent is getting more difficult for even humble developments, if we were to call them that. And so an avenue available to people is the court in an appeal against the council's decision either to not make a determination or to make a determination that is unfavourable.
Yeah, and I've sort of picked up on the fact that upon reflection, it's really something that levels the playing field in my view, because there's two ways to think about it. First thing is, okay, there is a misconception. There is a perception, I think, that Land Environment Court is somewhere where wealthy developers go hire expensive lawyers and get things through unreasonably. But I think balanced with that is, where a council's acting unreasonably, where a decision maker is not taking, you know, subjective things into account when making a decision and skewing it, then it really is a leveler, because the council can say whatever they like in the process, in the application process, but really in court, they can't say whatever they like. They're held to account. So that's how I thought about it. But is the reputation fair that wealthy people can just do whatever they want as long as they got a good lawyer and they can use, you know, loopholes and worm their way into doing whatever they need? Is that fair, or how do you see it from your end?
Well, I would say that there's no doubt that if you've got a lot of resources to throw at the matter, then you can create a very compelling case. But that doesn't guarantee you an outcome, and I would not say that it's the domain of wealthy developers who just take applications away from councils, put them in the court and get what they want. I would say that there are instances where big developers have good experts. Expert witnesses are key to land environment court matters, and they can employ expert witnesses who have a duty to the court, but also, of course, are coming at it from a position of their client, and they can provide a compelling argument to the court. We're generally talking about class one matters in the Land Environment Court, so development appeals, an appeal in the court of a decision made by a council or some other consent authority.
Yeah, because there are criminal matters, there's a raft of things that councils do. So there's tree disputes that's a good thing to qualify today. We're going to talk about, strictly speaking, class one, which is relevant to DA's development application.
Yeah, the court has a very wide jurisdiction to deal with a very wide range of matters to do with land and development and environment. But if we're talking about development appeals, then the judicial officer that hears those matters is a commissioner of the court, and they are generally experts in a particular field related to development in some form. And so they might be lawyers, they might be town planners, they might be architects, heritage consultants, that sort of thing, people who have reached the top of their particular discipline and are entrusted then by the court with hearing appeals of developments on an objective basis and giving that sort of check and balance to the decision making of consent authorities. And I certainly, from my time in various councils in New South Wales, I would have heard in the assessments team attitudes along the lines of, well, that house has already got 5 bedrooms. Why does it need another? Now, that's not a planning ground, but clearly it's a subjective opinion that has been allowed to develop, and it might have led to the refusal of a development application because of, you know, a perception that these people who own this land have already got more than they're entitled to or have maximized the development on the land. That, of course, is not necessarily the criteria that needs to be applied. And if a decision was infected with an attitude such as that, then an appeal in the court would allow for an objective approach, a balanced reconsideration of the decision, and would be focused on the planning controls and making good planning decisions rather than anything else.
Yeah, and I guess the other misconception is that you need a lot of money to go down that route. And sure, if you go to a hearing, that's probably true. But one of the key things that you learn is that apart from fees, I mean, it's really the hearing that's the painful, expensive part, preparing for that. And a lot of the times, through my experience, you can resolve matters with the council. They know because they're lawyers, and you, I guess, be great to get your insight, but council's own lawyers are kind of going, oh, well, you're probably going to lose this one. You should probably try and settle. So a lot of the times when you're, you know, where it's a reasonable, you know, when you're not asking for something unreasonable and council is being unreasonable, it's a legitimate avenue. And normally their solicitors, if they're worth their money, will say to council, the council planner, you're going to lose, just work something out. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think it is. And I suppose there's a couple of points to make there. The first one is that sometimes clients have come to me to get some advice on an appeal and they're a bit reluctant to do it because, you know, they've never been in trouble with the law before. They're unfamiliar with the process and there's just, it's just intimidating to see their name on court documents. But you're right in saying that it is a completely legitimate avenue to explore and to proceed down if a decision is dissatisfactory. And that's the term that's used in the Environmental Plan and Assessment Act, the dissatisfaction with the decision that has been made. And so it's not about suing the council. It's not about, you know, these sort of aggressive court type words that you hear. It's purely just acting on your right to have the decision of a consent authority reconsidered by an objective decision maker. So I would always say if you're dissatisfied with the decision that's been made, then you're welcome to explore that and you have the right to do so. And the other aspect is about costs. And you mentioned that there might be a misconception around costs. I think that's probably the case. You hear all these horror stories about court cases creating massive costs for the people involved, and commonly it's said that the only people that benefit from that is the lawyers. I'd probably like to correct that and say, at least in the Land Environment Court, costs aren't as significant as they are in other courts, perhaps. And for a standard Land Environment Court appeal of a decision on a development application, you would be looking at the court filing fee, which is paid to the court to commence the proceedings. You would have solicitors' fees to run the matter, to prepare court documents, to make sure everything is run correctly. Expert witness fees. Generally, most matters will involve issues of town planning, and so you need an expert to present your case on the planning merits, and there might be some other contentions that are raised by the council as part of the appeal, which might touch on other expert disciplines, for example, traffic or heritage. And it might be that you'll need an expert to be on board to provide evidence on those aspects. So their fees have to be taken into account. And in some circumstances, perhaps where the scale of the development is large or where the number of issues in dispute are significant, then there might be call for a barrister to be briefed as well.
Yeah. I'm relating it to my experience, you know, and I don't know how many matters exactly either that I've been involved with myself or helping clients with, but I don't know, 10 or 15, I guess, maybe closer to 10, but 90% resolvable with council. I guess in the course of a reasonable development and a smaller development, it rarely goes to a full hearing. I guess, is that reflected in the general stats, or is that just, have I just been lucky?
No, I think it is reflected in the general stats of the court, and the court does pride itself on alternative dispute resolutions, and generally most matters involve a two-step process, a conciliation conference and a final hearing. And lots of matters, I won't offer a percentage now just in case I'm wrong, and the stats are on the court's website, but I know they do publish the results on an annual basis. A high percentage of matters do settle at conciliation. And what tends to happen is you get a statement of facts and contentions prepared by the respondent consent authority in the first sort of couple of weeks of the appeal being afoot. And that sets out the council's argument against the development. And then at a conciliation conference, you talk through those issues and try and come to some kind of resolution on them, perhaps even settling them. And in the many matters that we've done together, Matt, I think you're being a bit shy in saying that we've had 100% success rate.
Oh, yeah.
Over the years. I'll toot the trumpet and say we've got 100% success rate.
100%. Steering gets 100%.
Yeah. And is it probably 80 or 90% have settled before a final hearing in conciliation or after a conciliation conference where we have offered some amendments to the development and that has satisfied council's concerns? It also, in many aspects, takes away the intensity of a council's argument on a particular issue and leads to, as you said, perhaps a solicitor then briefing the council that its position becomes untenable or unlikely to succeed. And so then we look towards the terms of a settlement. And that happens a lot. I think that's one of my strengths, given the town planning background, is that we can have a roundtable discussion at a conciliation conference and run through some changes that could be offered. And I try my very best in those instances to maintain the yield that the client needs from the development, and even sometimes try and add some beneficial aspects. So not necessarily just compromising. I don't think conciliation means an applicant compromising to get a settlement. It means a proper discussion of how else could this be done. And sometimes the changes are quite tokenistic and quite small and really don't affect the client's overall needs and the outcome that is sought.
And sometimes the changes are really, really dumb. You just go, why are we here talking about the colour of a fascia board that someone might see at 3 o'clock, in the afternoon from a particular spot? And I remember being in a room of lawyer, two sets of solicitors and a planner and a heritage, maybe two heritage consultants up for council. And I just thought, this is the biggest waste of money imaginable. And with that discussion was over literally the color is the color of something and the pitch of something.
We've definitely had a discussion on shades of grey. I don't think there were 50, but there was not far off that. And there's certainly certain colours that are preferred by heritage officers. And at that point where you're talking about the colours, you kind of know that the settlement is in the offing. And at that point, then it's about bringing the parties together and getting an outcome that suits both. But on the costs issue, if you can get the settlement at that point, that's probably going to save some costs, and certainly the costs that are incurred then if the conciliation fails and you have to go to a final hearing where it's a full court case in front of the commissioner in court, and both sides of the dispute present their argument, that's where the costs of preparation and the time spent in court arguing about the outcome, that's where the additional costs are incurred.
Yeah, totally. And the one thing that I learned early on is that just be aware of the application fee before you submit your DA, because this is for small developments, up to $500,000. Application fees around $1,000. And then the minute you go a dollar more, or the minute you click over to 500,000, the application fee is $4,000. So if you're submitting a DA for $500,000, make it just discount it by a dollar, and you'll save yourself $3,000. So it seems like a funny sliding scale, but it is what it is, right? Someone decided at some point.
Yes. And perhaps those brackets need to be looked at in light of current construction costs. You're right in saying that for developments less than $500,000, the fee is around $1,000, actually $1,026, where filed in the name of an individual, it's nearly double that if it's filed in the name of a corporation. Then there's a significant jump, and the final bracket is for developments of $1 million or over, and the filing fee for that is $5,856.
Yeah, but the substantial jump is that you know, from $499,099 to $500,000. That's triples or quadruples.
But yeah, but even that top bracket as well, for you know there could be a development for the construction of a single house that would cost over $1 million to build. And that pays the same fee as a development for 300 units. Doesn't quite seem right.
Yeah.
So maybe that's something that the court can reevaluate on. And there is a court user group that meets and hears the concerns of practitioners. It might be something that is reexamined.
Yeah. Or when you're, when Stephen Griffiths becomes the chief commissioner, he can maybe help. Have more say in things like that.
Yeah, well, I probably think I'd have to become the chief judge, and we might be waiting a bit longer for that to happen.
Yeah. Okay, so just jumping back to the exclusivity of the court, I guess the funny thing about Land Environment Court is, and like any other court, anyone can it's open to anyone, right? Anyone can put a submission in. And is there a reason why they would consider doing that or not doing that? I guess probably for simple things like not class one, then people probably are more likely to put their own submission in. But is it unusual for someone to file their own?
What do you mean by submission? Do you mean an appeal or?
An appeal. That's, I knew what I meant, Stephen.
Well, yeah, as you said earlier, if you're the applicant of a development application and the decision that has been made on it is dissatisfactory, then you have the right to appeal it. You also have the right to appeal it and have somebody represent you. And so that could be a lawyer or it could be an agent. An agent needs leave of the court to appear in the court. That's the difference between.
And just jumping to a different aspect. So one of the things that most people don't know about submitting a DA to council is that councils, I think we agreed not to mention any names of councils today, but one council I know that I won't name takes like 90 days on average or has a target of 80 days and ends up taking 90 days to determine submissions or to determine, I guess, in a technical word for decide what happens with your DA submission, whether it's DA is granted or not. But what most people probably wouldn't know is that after 42 days, maybe different jurisdictions, but after there is a set period where after inaction, you can have a deemed refusal. And we offer that to our clients who are time sensitive, who are time focused. We offer that option. We give them that lever to pull. And as a courtesy, we actually tell them when that is so that they knew that they had that option. But is that a bad thing to do? Can that be counterproductive to take counsel to court after 42 days?
I suppose it depends on what are the drivers of the application. So there is the option for applicants to press the button on an appeal and act on their right to appeal in the court after this deemed refusal period of 40 days. And I have clients whose whole strategy are that that's what they intend to do. And once that period has ticked over, then they're on the phone to me to say, those court papers that you prepared last week ready to go on a deemed refusal, can you now put those into the court? And we do so. And it is a matter of timing, because the longer you wait to hear from counsel and to get a determination from counsel, the further into the future the availability of the court goes for things like conciliation conferences. And so if time is a significant factor and it doesn't look like an approval is going to be granted by the counsel, then applicants should seriously consider acting on the right of a deemed refusal and commencing an appeal on that basis.
And is there any reason why you wouldn't? Like, is there any counter to that? What are the downsides of...
The downsides of doing it are that, first of all, it's unlikely that the DA will be advanced any further by the counsel. That's not to say it can't be. If you act on the right of deemed refusal, then the DA is still alive and the counsel can still determine it one way or the other, either approval or refusal. But in circumstances where a court appeal has been commenced, it tends to be that the counsel then put that file to one side and let the court decide and let the court process play out. The other potential downside is that, as you would expect with the court, all issues are looked at very finely, and the detail of assessment sometimes is a lot more specific than the kind of assessment you get from a counsel. And what was not an issue to the counsel might become an issue on appeal. And so there have been instances where I've been involved in cases that have sort of sailed through counsel on one particular issue, but have hit the rocks for something else. And we end up arguing about the issues that were not the cause of why the appeal was filed in the first place.
So I guess the potential downside of a preemptive submission is that you may have had it approved and you're not sure, but also you open yourself up to everything becomes negotiable, so to speak. Some things that may have been a non-event in the original application may be contested. And I guess that's my experience, is when counsel puts their list of contentions, they put everything down. Like, it's almost like everything. And why do they do that? What's the purpose of putting everything in as a contention and expanding the list of contentions?
Well, they're not bound to issues that have been discussed during the assessment process. They're not even bound to the reasons for refusal, given where the development application has actually been determined and refused. So everything is back on the table. And what you tend to see is the statement of facts and contentions is filed early in the proceedings. And that is counsel's really their one and only opportunity to say what is wrong with the development and why it shouldn't be approved. And so some counsels take the strategy that let's throw everything on the kitchen sink at this, just to, you know, the philosophy of if you throw enough mud, something will stick type thing. Other councils take a different approach and they say, well, we're not going to just add things in there that unlikely to be successful. Let's keep it to the core issues and make sure that these main issues are dealt with rather than being caught up in the chaos that sometimes results from throwing everything in. I have to say it's usually more of a case that they throw everything than they tend to think that more is better. And so you do have to deal with a lot of issues, but quite often a lot of the sort of peripheral issues are easily addressed and sometimes don't need any further documentation or submission. It's just a matter of having that discussion. And if the council then accepts a position on particular issues and states that it doesn't press that contention any further, then the court doesn't necessarily have to explore it.
Yeah, I guess the other part is there's cost incurred on both sides. So obviously it feels like, well, the more they put in there, the more it's going to cost them, the more work. And you kind of go, well, that's the opposite to most experience of council where they actually try and reduce the workload. So it's kind of counterproductive, but I have to say it's, I'm always sort of baffled by the adding lots of things in. It's never made sense to me what the underlying purpose of thinking is.
Yeah, well, I would agree with that. And I'd say that in the matters where I have represented some of the council clients of my firm, I prefer to draft contentions which are robust and will stand up to scrutiny and not just thrown in to pad things out. Because like you say, you're going to have an expert to deal with whatever disciplines those contentions raise. And that's costs for the council that are unrecoverable. We haven't really talked about costs in proceedings, but generally in Class 1 matters, there should be no expectation that a particular party can recover costs from the other. And the thinking behind that is that an applicant should not be deterred from seeking a just outcome through the threat of a costs order if they're unsuccessful. And likewise, a consent authority should not be deterred from properly defending an appeal under the threat of a costs order.
It's different to most courts, I guess. Not that I know a lot, but certainly, yeah, where it's a contractual claim or similar or defamation, the costs certainly come into it big time. But Land Breimer is a little bit different. Is there any circumstance where there's a cost liability?
Yes, there are some circumstances that might give rise to a costs order in Class 1 proceedings. One statutory entitlement is where for developments other than what we might call small residential developments, if the application is amended, then a consent authority has the right to have its costs thrown away, paid by the applicant. And so, again, I repeat that that's not for small residential developments, such as single dwellings, dual occupancies, alts and ads, anything related to those kinds of developments. There's no costs thrown away in those proceedings. But let's say, for example, we're acting for a small property developer who wants to build some townhouses. It doesn't fit in the court's residential development appeals stream. And as part of the conciliation process, we are able to settle the issues with the council, but it requires us to amend the plans. The council then is entitled to a costs order for its costs that have been wasted as a result of the amendment of the application. So preparation of a statement of facts and contentions to draft contentions, which are now no longer relevant. Perhaps some of the instruction to planners, to experts, those are the kind of things that could be costs thrown away and are available. But generally, if we're talking about small residential developments, there is no costs thrown away. And in all Class 1 matters, there's no entitlement to costs, whether you're successful at the end or not. It really only comes down to whether there has been some significant unreasonableness on a particular party's part during the proceedings that perhaps a costs order would be granted. For example, if an applicant had to seek leave of the court to vacate hearing dates at very short notice, and that causes inconvenience to everybody and costs to the other parties, then that might be something that the court says, well, that's completely unreasonable. In the event that they might grant a vacation of hearing dates, then they might do so with an order for costs of the other parties. But it's rare. Generally, people don't have to worry about the costs of their opponent in these types of proceedings. There are other jurisdictions in the court where that does occur, but not in these development appeals.
And is it a fair system? Because I guess assuming someone has quality representation and all the money and substantial resources, are they always going to win? I mean, is it a fair system? To me, it feels, I've kind of always had a positive regard for the court and the way it's conducted, and you have your heritage consultants in there, and that's always a funny affair, but it seems like it works. It seems like if you're reasonable, you're probably going to win. Is that fair, or is it just because I've had a brilliant lawyer?
Well, definitely the latter. But look, I think most of the time, if you've got good representation and good experts, then you're on strong footing. But you're not guaranteed to win even when you do have those things. It is an expert court, and the decision makers are experts in their field, and so they're informed. And I explained it to a client the other day where perhaps you go into a Supreme Court matter and a judge is allocated to the case that has expertise in a particular area but has to hear a court matter that is not in their expertise area. In the Land Environment Court, you will have a commissioner who has experience in the type of matter that is before them. And it's particularly useful for things like heritage, where heritage views can be quite subjective. And I find the controls around heritage are usually very broad and open to interpretation and open to adoption from either side of for or against, depending on your particular view on what should be conserved and what perhaps is not so important to the heritage significance of a particular property. So you're dealing with an expert judicial officer, and they rely on the expert witnesses, but they also have their own views on certain things. And unlike other types of court matters where the judge sits and hears the case, a commissioner can actually become involved and ask questions of expert witnesses. And there could be circumstances where, even though a very good case is run, a commissioner decides not to grant consent. Those are rare, and I think I can only really think of one example in my career in the Land Environment Court where I've left the court thinking, after a final hearing, I defeated my opponent in presenting my case, but then we got an adverse decision, and it was just the case that I might have presented a better case than the opponent, but it was still not quite enough to convince the commissioner that consent should be granted. And so that is the whole merit assessment aspect that comes with the court. Generally, I think it's a much more level playing field. We mentioned that earlier, with respect to the commissioner brings a fresh set of eyes to it. They're not hindered by perhaps long-held internal policies or particular interpretations of planning controls that might exist within councils. And they just look at the controls on the bare words and interpret them as they're supposed to do and makes a decision based on that. And so we have seen matters where the position of the council is based on a series of decisions and maybe an interpretation of a planning control that has been long held. And once you get into the court, a commissioner just looks at the bare words of what the planning control requires and doesn't necessarily adopt the policy or the interpretation of the council. And I think that's a good thing.
I've got some key takeaways that I was going to put to you and see if I missed anything. So I was going to say that we've decided in the court of Buildopedia that it is a legitimate avenue. It does level the playing field. Secondly, it's a call for experts. Like, and if anything, Steve demonstrated a few times where I'm kind of going, geez, are we getting too technical for our listeners? Maybe it is a court not to self-represent. I mean, we've outlined certainly other parts of the Land Environment Court. You might choose to put application in, but certainly planning as demonstrated by the explanation about planning controls, you really got to get someone like Stephen involved. And I think the third thing is it doesn't have to be as expensive and as daunting as people commonly think. You know, you don't need to set aside $100,000. You could put the application in and see how it's going and potentially abandon it if it's, you don't, you're not obliged to hand over wads of money at any point in time. So and typically it doesn't go to a hearing. That's the other point. It typically gets resolved prior to a hearing. There's mechanisms within the court. Is there anything I've missed? Is there anything you want to add to that sort of list of key takeaways?
I think they're good takeaways. Like, it is definitely a legitimate avenue. It's sometimes a strategic decision as well, depending on how the assessment of the application is going. And you have the right of appeal. And so if you don't get the decision that you want, then look into the right of appeal. It is a court for experts, but like you say, the costs aren't as crazy as they might be in other courts. And we mentioned earlier that we settle a lot of matters before they get to a final hearing, and that helps with costs, but it also helps with some design aspects on occasion where you can improve or massage a certain type of design to get an outcome without having to go all the way to a final hearing. I suppose the one thing that I would say in addition to that is that you don't have to be daunted by it. One client explained it to me very well in that he explained that when he considered the fees for solicitors and expert witnesses and the fees to file the application with the court, it was still considerably less in terms of a monetary value to him than what he could gain from getting the outcome that he needed for his property. And so I'm sure those smarter than me can look at the very bare numbers and the mathematics to what's it going to cost as opposed to what is the value add. And then you can look at that and determine whether or not it works. But generally, from what I understand, it does.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe you can think of it another way, Stephen. Like, maybe it's because you're going to go maybe to court for things that are worthwhile going to court about. Maybe if it's not worthwhile, maybe you don't have any involvement in those things, you know, because people make that assessment, I guess, most of the time rationally and go, well, it's not worth it because it doesn't add enough value to warrant the process and the fees. And Stephen, how do we, so you're a partner at Bardia Perry. If people want planning advice, what do they need to do?
Yes, shameless plug time.
Shameless plug.
They can look me up on the Bardia Perry website, which is bartier.com.au, BARTIER. We're a full service law firm except for criminal law. And so I'm a partner in the environmental planning team, but there's a whole range of experts at the firm that could assist in a number of legal issues that might arise in the listeners' lives. And so, feel free to get my contact details off the website and give me a call if you want to discuss any matters that need some assistance.
And I understand you've been shortlisted for, is it am I misquoting? Is it Lawyer of the Year in the Australia's Most Desirable Lawyers? What was the publication?
Matt, you're embarrassing me now. I did ask you specifically not to talk about this, or was it that I did ask you to specifically talk about it? I can't remember.
Maybe.
It's the Lawyers Weekly Partner of the Year for Environment and Planning. So that's coming up in July. Very nice to be shortlisted. Would be very nice to win too.
Yeah, well, we're all voting for you, Stephen. We don't know where to vote yet, but we're all voting in spirit. Well, good luck with it anyway.
Thanks and, very much. Thanks.
You're having an incredible year with your first child and shortlisted for Lawyer of the Year. So congratulations.
Thanks very much. Yeah, it has been a good year. And the reason for the nomination was that in the calendar year, I'd achieved 100% success rate in development appeals in the Land Environment Court. And so that is a pretty rare thing in a lawyer's career to get 100% success rate, either settling or winning at hearing in a calendar year. So that was the reason. It's a pretty good story, I think. And so I hope that it pleases the judges.
I expect nothing less, Stephen. All right. Thanks so much. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Buildopedia. Please remember to like us and share our episode with your friends. We'd love your comments and suggestions. And we have a new website, buildopedia.au, where you can get in touch or leave a question and check out our blog.